The first speaker is Audrey Gash, who's an assistant professor in genetics here. Audrey studies the response of yeast to environmental stress, in particular the changes that go on in signaling pathways and other molecules that control the action of genes. So I think this should be a really interesting talk. The title is The Power of Yeast Using Model Organisms to Study Environmental Interactions and Evolution. Great. Thank you, Dana. And it's great to see so many people here. I am the first talk in the afternoon. Let me turn this down a bit. And we've been asked to give some talks about our research. So what I'm going to try to do is give a basic overview of some of the research that we're doing to look at evolution, and in particular, how environmental interactions can shape evolution. Now, for many people, when we think about evolution, we think about the tremendous amount of variation that we can see with our eyes in the living world around us. And of course, creatures vary in amazing ways in terms of their shape, their size, their color, their form, and also in the ways that they interact with their environments and the kind of environments that they can survive in. And evolutionary biologists have many different questions about this broader issue, including understanding the evolutionary history of different organisms, how these organisms have been shaped by their environmental interactions, and also in understanding the genetic causes of these phenotypic variations. So this is the amazing diversity that we see every day. This is the kind of diversity that we work on in our lab. This dynamic creature is the budding yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And so what I'm showing here are a number of pictures of different strains of yeast. They could just as easily be different species. The main point of this slide is they don't really look very dynamic. It is true that they vary to some extent in their size and their shape. But when we study evolution, we're not really thinking about we're not looking at what these organisms look like. We are instead looking at the beauty and the intricacies of what happens inside the cell. This diagram here is a cartoon of metabolic pathways inside cells. This has to do with how molecules are used and manipulated and shunted down different pathways in organisms. And metabolic pathways are typically very well conserved across many different organisms. However, what's important to us is that they can still vary from species to species. How these pathways and metabolites and chemicals are used by organisms can change. We're also, as Dana said, very interested in the intricacies of protein-protein interactions in the cell that are involved in what's known as signal transduction. So cells need to be able to monitor their environment and sense when there's a challenge or a problem that they need to respond to. They need to detect these environmental features, and then based on the way that proteins interact, they can move around in the cell, they modify one another to essentially allow the cell to coordinate a response to environmental conditions. So these features to us are the beautiful, intricate details of how evolution can work. So in our lab, we're interested in a number of basic questions. How does cellular function vary through evolution? What are the consequences of the different kinds of variation that we see? And in particular, what role does the environment play in shaping this evolution? Now, budding yeast, I would argue, is a great system to study these things in for a couple of reasons. First of all, this species, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, is the same kind of yeast that's used to make wine and to make beer. So it's been used by humans for really millennia. It also, for the last 100 years, has been known as a model organism, which means that many basic researchers are trying to understand basic features of biology by studying this model system. The reason it's a model is because much of what happens in the cellular level in yeast is conserved all the way up to humans. So they're easy to study, we can work with yeast and make inferences about higher organisms. But what's interesting to us and important for what we're doing is that yeast cells are also real living creatures that can exist in very diverse environments all over the globe. So budding yeast can be found in decaying fruit, vineyards. They're often found on the surface of grapes. Alcoholic fermentations, as I mentioned, have used yeast for really thousands of years. Turns out budding yeast can also be found in soil associated with different kinds of trees. In fact, we've even collected Saccharomyces cerevisiae from soil in Wisconsin. They can also be associated with clinical infections, primarily in immunocompromised people.
So because yeast strains are found in very, very different environments, and because it's a model organism, we have a lot of genetic and genomic tools that allow us some really unique opportunities to study ecology and evolution and the genetic basis of some of these things at the same time. And I'll describe what I'm talking about in a moment. So the first thing that we wanted to look at was how these different yeast strains vary in their phenotypes. Should I say what I mean by strain? We're really talking about different genetic backgrounds that are all part of the same species. It's kind of like thinking about different breeds of dogs. They're really the same species, they can mate with one another, but they have very different phenotypes or genetically encoded differences in their look and behavior. So we wanted to start by looking at how strains of yeast collected from different environments vary in their behavior. Now this diagram is pretty complicated. I'll just walk you through it for a minute. The main point I want to get across is pretty simple. And that is that different strains of yeast that are experts at growing in different kinds of environments have very, very different behaviors. What we're looking at here is the ability of different strains of yeast to survive different environmental stresses. And so each row here, with a little colored text, represents a different yeast strain. You don't even need to be able to read it. The strains are color-coded according to the environment in which they were collected from. So then in the lab, we can simply grow each one of these strains in the presence of all of these different chemicals, toxins, different nutrient sources, different temperatures, and score how well those cells can grow or survive. All of these colored purple boxes represent the ability of cells to grow in these different conditions. So a bright purple box, according to this key, indicates that the cells are really good at surviving that stressful condition. Whereas you see some gray boxes here, that represents that those strains cannot grow under those conditions. The main point I want to get across with this slide is, hopefully you can see, there's a lot of color here. Lots of dark purple boxes, lots of gray boxes, and shades in between. That tells us that these strains are really very, very different in the kinds of environments that they can survive. We find some yeast strains that are experts at surviving, for example, heavy metals, and other strains that are very, very sensitive to heavy metal stress. So now what we are trying to understand is really two things. One is we'd like to understand the genetic reason, the genetic basis for these different tolerances to different stresses. But we would also really like to know, has the environment in which these cells have evolved essentially provided a mechanism or a force for evolution such that the cells are selected to display those phenotypes? And I'll get more into that in a moment. So for the rest of my talk, what I really want to focus on is one stress in particular that we're looking at, which is freeze-thaw tolerance. So in this last column here, you see a bunch of boxes. And what you see is that we see some dark purple boxes for a set of strains. That indicates that these strains here are experts at surviving freeze-thaw stress. So we live in Wisconsin. Everybody, I'm sure, is aware that hypothermia is bad. You can't freeze yourself typically and survive very well. But these yeast cells are experts, very, very good at surviving freezing and thawing. Most of the other strains in our analysis cannot survive freezing and thawing at all. Now, it just so happens that the strains here, colored in orange, that are freeze-thaw tolerant, were collected from Pennsylvania, from soil of oak trees, and so that, of course, is an environment that experiences winter, whereas most of the other strains here were collected from warm environments. Coincidence? Maybe so. That's what we're trying to understand. So our first question is, why are these oak strains from Pennsylvania so good at surviving freezing and thawing? And so, again, this is the power of yeast. We have a lot of genetic tools. We can use genetic analysis to identify the genes that are important for this phenotype, freeze-thaw tolerance. And what I should say is most of the work that I'm going to talk about for the rest of my talk was done by our research technician, Jessica Will. And what Jessica found is that there are two genes that the oak strain carries. One is called aquaporin 1, and the other is called aquaporin 2. And it turns out that the version of these genes that the oak strains harbor in their genome are important for surviving freeze-thaw stress. So what is an aquaporin? Well, aqua means water, porin means pore. And so these proteins are actually important for letting water flow in and out of the cell. This is a little cartoon of the cell membrane that surrounds the cell. This is the inside. This is the outside of the cell. These proteins, each one of these genes, encodes some proteins that make a little channel that water can flow in and out of. Why is that important for freeze-thaw stress? Well, it turns out aquaporins were already linked to this freeze-thaw stress, because what's really toxic about freezing and thawing is when the water inside the cell crystallizes and breaks apart the cellular structure. So cells that have these pores, when they freeze, all of the water rushes out of the cell, and that allows them to survive freezing and thawing. What was really interesting to us is that we see a perfect correlation. The strains that are freeze-thaw tolerant have these aquaporin genes, and the strains that are sensitive to freezing and thawing don't have functional aquaporins. What we can tell by looking at their DNA sequences, they have short deletions or chunks of these genes that are missing. So the proteins are no longer functional. Well, we can go on to test this, again, because with yeast we have genetic tools. And so what Jessie did was she took the oak strain that is can survive freezing and thawing, and she simply removed each of these genes and looked at the consequences. This is how we do genetic analysis. And the results are shown here. It's a little bit of data. So this orange bar on this bar plot shows the oak strain, and what I'm plotting is the tolerance of that strain to freeze-thaw stress. So the higher the bar, the better they are at surviving freeze-thaw stress. So these oak strains, we know, have two different copies of these aquaporin genes. If Jessie removes either one or the other of these genes, the cells still do pretty well surviving freezing and thawing. But now if she removes both of the genes from the oak strain, they now are completely unable to survive freeze-thaw stress. And their phenotype, their sensitivity, looks just like our lab strain that we can see has lost the aquaporin genes. So this is really, I would say, unique compared to a lot of other organisms in which people are asking evolutionary questions, because it's so easy to manipulate yeast. Now, what Jessie also did that's very nice is she can actually take these aquaporin genes from the oak strain and put them into the lab strain. And what she found is that now, by introducing just a single gene into the lab strain, they can become somewhat freeze-thaw tolerant. So this is, I think, fairly conclusive evidence that these genes are really what's important for freeze-thaw stress. Okay, so how is this related to evolution? Well, now we're very interested. I mentioned that not that many strains in our collection are freeze-thaw tolerant. Most of the strains that are sensitive to freeze-thaw stress don't have these aquaporin genes. They've lost chunks of the genes, so the genes are no longer functional. So one possibility is that this function is just no longer needed. For example, I mentioned these strains now live in warm climates. Maybe they never experience freeze-thaw stress. They just don't need these aquaporins anymore. And just by chance, they happen to lose them, and there's no consequence to those strains. So they just randomly lost them, and they don't care anymore because they don't need those genes. The other possibility is that the function is no longer needed because they're in warm climates, but maybe there's also an advantage to losing these genes. Now, this is a very different mechanism because it suggests that there may have been selection through evolution for cells that have lost the aquaporins. What that means is that maybe cells that have lost the aquaporins, if they're in the right environment, actually do better than their neighbors. And so Jessie recently found that this appears to be the case. The oak strain, the normal oak strain that has these water channels, is fairly sensitive to what's known as osmotic stress. It's related to dehydration, and maybe I'll just say that. So you can imagine if cells lose water very easily, they might be really sensitive to drying out. We're actually using a different kind of stress that's related to that. But what Jessie finds is that the normal cells that have these aquaporin genes are pretty sensitive to this type of stress. But now if she removes these two genes, the ability of cells to survive this osmotic shock goes up. So what that really means is that these aquaporin genes, when they're functional, making these functional water channels, can provide a benefit to cells, freeze-thaw tolerance, if they're in the right environment. But having these genes could be a disadvantage if cells are growing in environments where they dry out very easily. And so what this means is that there's really a balance in evolution or in these populations as to whether it's beneficial to keep the aquaporin genes or whether it's better to lose them. For cells that are growing in environments where there is a winter or very cold climates, maybe the benefit of having these aquaporin genes outweighs the benefit of not having them. So those, this is our hypothesis anyway, we're still trying to test it, but maybe the strains that are growing in the wintry climates, winter is a much bigger problem for them. It's a force for them to keep these water channel genes around. Incidentally, I should say that we've recently been collecting yeast cells from Wisconsin, and lo and behold, almost all of the ones that we've looked at are freeze-thaw tolerant, and they have aquaporin genes. So that's consistent with our hypothesis. So these are still things that we're trying to address using other types of techniques, but the main part of my talk is that two things. One is that by using these model organisms where we have a lot of tools to look at the mechanism, the DNA, the very details of these phenotypes, we can get at the fine-grained details of how organisms evolve. The other point I want to make is considering the environment that these organisms grow in is really critical for how we think about the evolution of these yeasts, the evolution of their DNA, and the forces behind maintaining or losing different types of genes. It really is a context dependent. And with that, I'm just going to stop. And I want to in particular thank our research technician, Jesse Will, who did most of this work. Dan Quiddick was a former graduate student who did some of the initial exploration of the phenotypes of these strains. So I'll stop there, and if there's time, I'm happy to take a few questions. Thanks.
Yes. Since these genes are being lost because they're not needed, and you're propagating these strains in your lab, do you have to do anything special to make sure that your strains do not...
That is an excellent question. I'm so glad you asked it. Because one of the results that emerged from our initial analysis, the purple box plot I showed you, when we were looking at the phenotypes of different strains, well, one thing that we noticed was that the strains that people have used for almost a century in the lab are very different from all of the other natural strains that we've looked at. And so the question that you're asking, do we have to be careful about how we propagate these things in the lab, is very, very intuitive. And the answer is yes, actually. So what we think happened is that for the model organisms that have been manipulated for decades in the lab, have inadvertently been selected because of that process. So it's evolution in action, but with a human force. We think part of that is just the conditions that they're grown in the lab. And also, you know, we human researchers are constantly growing up the strains, picking cells off of a plate, and that's probably not random. When we go to pick the yeast cells out of our culture, we pick the biggest ones that are the easiest to pick. In doing that very simple act, we actually are probably selecting for a certain mutants. And so the answer to your question is yes, actually. These guys can actively change and do change when they're in the lab for a long time. Another question?
Is there any chance that when these genes are lost, probably by a mutation or something, that the new gene actually does something beneficial?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. So, yes, there's evidence for that. So, when I was saying the genes were lost, I was oversimplifying. In some cases, we can see that a chunk of the gene was taken out, and those we really think those genes are no longer making protein. But in some cases, we can see only some of the amino acids in the protein had changed. In other words, there is a potential to still function. And there is some evidence that those proteins are still made from these aquaporin genes, but they no longer transport water. They let other small molecules through, like nitrogen. And so we haven't been studying that directly in the lab, but your question about can you pick up a new function by changing these genes is absolutely true. And that's also a major force. A major model for how new functions can arise. You start with a gene or a protein that has one function, and by subtly changing it, you can actually change the function of the protein. Has that answered your question? Great. Thanks. Okay, thank you very much.